Good afternoon. Everybody take your seats. We're going to get started. We have a pretty full agenda, and we want to give our testifiers some time here. So I am calling the meeting to order for the Education Policy Committee, and there is a quorum present. And has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes? I see Representative Baker has. Do you have
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from yesterday's meeting. I can't see the date, January 15th, 2019.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Baker moves the minutes for January 15th. Any questions? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Yes,
Representative Chair. There's just a technical correction that needs to be noted on the first line. Sorry.
And what is that technical correction?
The time, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Erickson. 2:30 on, to add PM to that?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, that would be good. We should put PM on that. Thank you. We accept your technical correction. And with that correction, the minutes are approved for Tuesday, January 15th. All right. So, as we said before, we're going to kind of go over today how schools are funded. So you kind of, yesterday we talked about some of the rules our schools are living by. Now we're going to talk about the money they get. And then next week we're going to talk about the kiddos that show up in their doors. So we are going to turn it over right now to the Department of Education's fiscal analyst, Emily Andreessen, the House Research Department's education, Department of Education fiscal analyst, Emily Andreessen. And the House Research Department policy, education policy, legislative analyst, Tim Strong. Thank you, and I totally butchered your title, so why don't you go ahead and repeat them for the record, please?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I'm Tim Strong from House Research, and I'll be working primarily with Christina in this committee, and then in the full committee, Christina, myself, and Emily Adrians from House Fiscal Staff will be the staff assisting the Education Finance Division.
Thank you, and Representative Scott?
Oh, we'll get closer. Representative Scott, is that better? Perfect.
Thank you.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adrians and I are going to try and compress a quick overview of school finance into about 30 minutes for you, leaving a little time for questions. We're going to do this with four documents in your folder, and Ms. Adrians is going to start with an overview of the appropriations that we've got. The four documents in your folder are appropriations, levies, a PowerPoint, and a district-by-district printout, and we'll start with the appropriations overview.
So, Madam Chair and members, as Mr. Strom said, the first sheet, it's just a one-pager, and at the top it says Education State Aid. And we're really trying to do this in a quick fashion, so please, when you have questions, come talk to us at any point during the entire session, because it is a really complicated area of finance. And traditionally, the education finance spreadsheet looks a little bit more like this. So it's really, you know, it's got a lot of columns and a lot of lines, but I tried to really synthesize it down into just a high-level overview. So the sheet that you have in front of you, this is just for one fiscal year, for fiscal year 2019. And another thing I want to point out is that traditionally when you get information from fiscal analysts, like in our tracking sheets and even other documents, it will usually be in thousands. So you should always try to look, because there's a big difference between 9 million and 9 billion. So try to keep that in mind too. But again, always ask if you're not sure. So for the E-12 education program area, and the numbers that we're looking here, this is just the state aid portion. So this isn't, we'll talk more about the levies after this. But what I really want to point out, so the first line, the general education line, this is $7.2 billion of spending in 1 year. And this is really, this is the bulk of the spending that's done in the E-12 education area from the state. And this is going to include the basic formula allowance revenue. So the number that you'll hear throughout session, the amount per pupil for 2019, it's $6,312. And so this is, that's built into this this number. And then it also is going to include other general education components. So this will also have, like, the referendum revenue, compensatory spending, local optional, operating capital sparsity, those kind of things. And we will touch on a lot of these parts of the formula as we talk. So don't worry if none of it sounds familiar or makes sense quite yet. The education excellence area is the next line on here. That's a much smaller amount, almost $400 million. And this is the area that this will include things like achievement and integration aid, alternative teacher comp, which is also known as Q comp, charter school building lease aid. Those are some of the big big items in that line. Special education is $1.5 billion. So if you include general education and special education, out of the total for the year of the $9.6 billion that gets spent, that's about 92% of the total. So this is like where the bulk of the spending really happens in the E-12 education area. We also have facilities and technology. This is where the long-term facilities maintenance equalization aid is contained. Nutrition programs, this is like school lunch, school breakfast. Library programs, the early childhood and family support, that's just under $170 million. That's where we have programs like the early learning scholarships, ECFE, Head Start, school readiness. That's where those are all contained. Community education and prevention, and then self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. That's where adult basic education is contained. So all the programs will total up to about $9.5 billion. And then we also have spending for the state agencies that are included in this area of the state budget. So the Department of Education makes up the bulk of it, just under $33 million. And this is just for administration of programs. So this, you're not going to find program spending here. It's for the administration of it. And then PELSB, the Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board, that's in there. That's formerly the Board of Teaching. And then the Minnesota State Academies. I want to make a point here that the Minnesota State Academies line, this is the two schools. So it's the Minnesota State Academy for the Deaf and the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind are both on that line item. And then the Perpich Center for Arts Education is the last one at just over $8 million. So the agencies, along with the programs total, is $9.6 billion for fiscal year 19. And then just to give you some sense of the biennium total, because we'll talk mostly about the biennium, so when we're planning for the next, the upcoming years for 20 and 21, you'll hear more of the combined total. And that, for the 18 and the 19 biennium total, that was about $18.8 billion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. And Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, members, the second document we're going to go to is the levy. Mm. In addition to the state aid of about $9.6 billion for fiscal year 19, and fiscal year 19 is the 2018-2019 school year, so that's the school year we're in now. In addition to the state aid, there's also levies for that year, and you've got a separate sheet with a little pie chart on the back of it that's labeled School District Certified Levies Pay 18 by Category. And you can see on the top line there that to go with that $9.6 billion of state aid, there is also $2.88 billion of local certified property tax levies by the individual school districts. And we've tried to break this down in a few categories for you. You can see that there's quite a number of levies. The top two lines show the two different tax bases that are used for school levies. The first is the referendum market value tax base, and that's used primarily for the operating referendum that local districts approve. There's also local optional revenue and a couple other little levies on referendum market value, and that makes up about $1.1 billion of local levy. And then the remainder of school districts' levies are computed on adjusted net tax capacity and spread on that tax base as well, and they total about $1.7 billion. And then what we've done is we've broken these down by fund for you and sorted them from most to least in each fund. So you can see in the general fund, which is the money for operating, school districts have a series of funds, and for general operations they use their general fund. you can see that the largest single line item there is the operating referendum. There's $643 million of operating referendum that's been voter approved. There's $55 million that's board approved, and we can get into that at a later date if committee members are interested, and about $321 million of local optional revenue. Then as you go on down the list, you'll see that most of the bigger amounts are for building purposes, even though they're in the general fund. Those include things like long-term facilities, capital projects referendum, the building lease, operating capital. And you can see on down the list until you get to the very small levies. And unlike the state aids, these are listed as the billions, not in with the thousands of dollars. And so you can see we've got a couple of very small general fund levies at the very end. We've got one called tree growth for some northern school districts back when the old stumpage fees were eliminated. Districts that touch Canada are eligible for a swimming pool levy, again, a discussion of its own. And for reorganization of school districts, there's a very small amount that's levied there as we haven't had any reorganizations in recent years involving debt. So the general fund total then, $1.79 billion. Then there are a series of levies. Another fund is the Community Education Fund. And you can see the levies in that area for the regular community ed services, about $40 million. ECFE has a levy of $22 million. The school age care program, which provides aftercare activities, including for disabled students, a school district can levy for those in grades K through 6 for the school age care program, and that's about $17 million currently, and then a few smaller ones as well. The third fund that's listed on here is the debt service fund, and school districts use their debt service fund to repay building bonds. When a school district builds a new school building, usually what they'll do is they'll have the voters approve a bond issue. The district will sell the bonds, usually a 20-year bond, and then each year they'll levy to repay that bond. It's a lot like a mortgage payment for the district, and you can see that fund, there's about $918 million of school district levies that are used. About a third of them are used to repay building bonds. And then the last fund that's listed is something called OPEB, and OPEB stands for Other Post-Employment Benefits. And what's happened with school districts is a number of school districts had provisions to pay for certain health care costs for retired employees. And in Minnesota, that's the basically the only category that fits the definition of OPEB. And districts are allowed to levy for certain of those costs. They're allowed, one group of districts in 2008, rather, was given the authority to sell bonds for OPEB, and you see those amounts listed here, the $91 million per year here. And then if you were to look back up about halfway through the general fund, there's something that says annual OPEB, and for all the other districts that didn't issue bonds for their OPEB costs, they can make an annual levy for the previous year's unreimbursed costs for health care for retired employees, and that's about $39 million. So very quickly, Madam Chair, this shows you how the $2.9 billion of levy is distributed among the 30 or so programs. The second column shows you the tax base that levy is spread on. The third column shows the number of districts exercising each of those levies. The fourth column talks about whether the levy is equalized or not, and then the last column shows whether an election is necessary or not. So, Madam Chair, that's a very quick overview of the $2.9 billion of school levies.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And maybe for those that aren't on Property Tax or Tax Committee, do you want to explain ANTC and RMV?
Yes, Madam Chair, the school districts use two different tax bases. The first of those is called referendum market value. And in the PowerPoint, we're not going to spend any time on it because of our limitations on total time today. But referendum market value is essentially the assessed value of all the property in the state, except that ag lands and seasonal rec is excluded from that. And that's the tax base that an operating referendum is spread upon, and there's no class rates in that, so business property pays the same dollar-for-dollar value as homestead property does. But for an operating referendum, the school district's essentially using that tax base. That means in the rural areas with the ag land excluded that many of the rural districts are quite property poor for purposes of the operating referendum. Net tax capacity is the tax base after the class rates are applied, and the class rates vary by property type. Homesteads have a class rate of 1%, ag land of a little under 0.5 for most ag land. The business property is generally at 2%. So those class rates change the ratios of the portion that's paid by each type of property. And on a net tax capacity basis, if we order districts from most tax base per pupil to lease, it's generally the farm and cabin districts that are at the very top of the list, districts with large amounts of commercial industrial property next, and then districts that are primarily residential tend to be some of the lowest tax-based districts on net tax capacity. And remember, always in the school world, our denominator when we talk about property wealth is pupil units. So if you're a growing district and have a ton of kids, you're likely to have lower per pupil tax base than if you're a district that's losing kids and slowly declining in enrollment.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair and members, forgive us for a minute. There is a lot of information in this PowerPoint presentation, and so feel free to look through it, but in the interest of time, we wanted to just choose a few of the slides to focus on, but we're happy to answer questions on any of the information that's in here. So if you'd flip to page 26, that's where we'll start. And this is, again, just to kind of give a general overview and a sense of where, so this slide talks about where the money comes from.
Excuse me, Ms. Andreessen.
Sure.
Could you first pronounce your last name again for me?
Sure, Madam Chair, it's Adrians.
Ms. Adrians,
similar
you tell
to
us?
Adrian.
Thank you. The PowerPoint, it's the pages, our handout itself has page numbers on the bottom. So for those who are following along or not, like me, it's page 9. Thank you.
Oh, my apologies.
No worries.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Okay. So if you will look for the slide that is at the title says where the money comes from. And so now we're moving from fiscal year 19 and we're going into the upcoming years that the legislature will be appropriating for. Fiscal year 20, the state general fund resources, the total that the legislature really has to use is the $26.89 billion number. And what this pie chart shows is it's a sense of where all the money comes from. So you'll see that the individual income tax revenue is 48%. So this makes up just about half of all of the revenue that's coming in. We have a fund balance transfer in, that's 12%. That's another big chunk of it. And then the sales tax revenue of 22%. So these are kind of the big ones. There's also state revenue from the statewide property tax, mortgage and deed, corporate bank, insurance, and liquor, cigarette, and gambling revenues as well. If you'll go to the next slide. So this is where the money goes. And we'll talk about base budget spending. So the legislature has the prerogative to change any spending that's coming up, but we start from a base. We have a base budget set for 2020. And so currently it's $23.57 billion. And when we are talking about general fund spending, education almost always makes up the majority of it. If you look at it on an all funds basis, then Health and Human Services uses more federal spending, so that would have a larger percentage of the pie. But when we're just talking about general fund spending, K-12 education is the biggest piece of the pie at 41%, Health and Human Services at 32%. And then you'll see all the other areas. Not that they're less important, but it's just to give you a sense of how much money is being spent on the different areas. And then we're going to skip ahead a few more slides.
Madam Chair, members, we'll skip just to the enrollment section and cut this down just a little bit for you. Two slides we wanted to show you on enrollment. The first shows since 1960, the top line shows the students enrolled in Minnesota schools. And the reason we're doing this is nearly all of the funding in our funding formulas depends on the students that are served by the school districts. And you can see in 1960, 671,000 students were enrolled in our public school system. 158,000 were enrolled, or a little less than 158,000 were enrolled in the non-public system. As the baby boom happened in that 10-year time, you can see in about 1970, Minnesota reached the maximum enrollment it was ever at, which was 921,957 pupils in the public system. And you can see that declining over time. 1984 was the low point at the recent low point of 695,000 students. And then you can see in 1991, the dashed line starts, and the dashed line signifies the charter school enrollment on top of the school district enrollment. So the if you follow across on the chart on the dotted line, that shows the total enrollment in the public system in districts and charters. And you can see how that's changed since 2000, basically, as you go across. You can see that it's grown for both charters and for the school districts, so that in fiscal year 18, we've got 870,000 students in the public school system, of which 814,000 are in the district system. One thing to add as we project out to 2023 through the November forecast, that enrollment will continue to grow by about 6,000 students per pupil, and we're probably not quite going to get to 900,000 under current projections, but we'll be pretty close to that when enrollment is expected to level off. The next chart we just want to spend 30 seconds on, and that shows the change in enrollment over time from 2003 by some groups of that might be of interest to this committee. The top line shows the free and reduced lunch count, going from an average of 27.4% of the students to 37.7% in that 15-year period. The second line shows the students of color growing from 18.9% to 32.5% in that same time period. The third line shows the special education pupil count, and as a percentage, you can see that hasn't changed very much over the 15 years, even though the costs have grown pretty substantially. And that's in large part because the kinds of disabilities that students are facing are different than what they were 15 years ago. And for many of the students with significant needs, their costs have grown pretty dramatically. So the change in enrollment there on special ed isn't really telling us the story about the change in special ed costs. And then the last line shows, the dotted line shows, the number of English learners growing from about 6% to 8.5%. And while on this chart that growth looks pretty level, growing slightly at a relatively uniform rate over time, that varies dramatically from district to district, both in the metropolitan area and in greater Minnesota. And we'd be glad to speak at length about that at a different time, if you like. Sure. Two other really quick things on enrollment. Starting in 2000 was the first year that the majority of the students in Minnesota since statehood had been located in the metropolitan area. That's increased now to about 55% of the students now live in the 48 school district, 7-county metropolitan area. And you can see the other two regions with about 10%, the East Central region, which wraps around the northern part of the Twin Cities from the Wisconsin border and around the northern end, and then the Rochester area, the southeast part of the state, is about 9% as well. And then finally, one other thing that comes into play a great deal with Minnesota's school funding formulas is Minnesota has about 165 charter schools and 330 school districts, but those districts vary dramatically by size. And if you group school districts into five even chunks or quintiles, you can see that the smallest 66 school districts serve 17,000 kids, or about 2% of the total. The next quintile serves about 4% of the students, or about 37,000 kids. And as you look to the right there, you can see that the largest 66 school districts serve 562,000, or about two-thirds of the school district students in the state, and charter school students in the state, are served in the 66 largest districts. So this makes Minnesota kind of unique, because we have a lot of really small districts with very specialized needs and several very, very large districts that are quite unlike many of the small districts in the state.
And then just to kind of reiterate some of the big areas of spending. So the next slide talks about the major components of the school finance system. So the total revenue for schools in fiscal year 2020 is just over $14 billion. And you can see on here, once again, general education makes up more than half of that share at 53%. Special education, 10.5%, another big chunk of it. And then facilities at almost 11%. So it's just another look at sort of how it gets where the money is coming in from. And then the next slide, general education revenue by component. This is that big number that I had on the first page of just over $7 billion. Or, well, here for 2020, it will be almost $8.6 billion. So the basic formula is the biggest portion of that. So that's that over $6,000 per pupil amount, and this is about 70.5%. And then some of the other big pieces of it, the referendum at 11%, the compensatory, that's the free and reduced lunch eligible students, that's 6.4%. And then you can kind of see the breakdown of where the rest of the funding goes for the different components within the general education revenue amounts.
So, Madam Chair, members, what this leads us to then is a printout, and we just want to explain the very basics of a district-by-district printout to you before we finish up back on the PowerPoint. And the district-by-district printouts, you're going to see, we can put any kind of information on them. The problem is always there tends to be too much information, so we're always trying to find a way to compress that in a way that fits on reasonably sized paper. The way most printouts are organized in this committee and for the Education Finance Committee, we'll list them in district number, which seems kind of odd, except that there is a pattern to district numbers, and that is the first two of the three digits of a school district number are usually the county number in alphabetical order. So, for instance, it keeps the Hennepin County school districts together that are all in County 27 because most of the Hennepin County districts are 270s in the 270s. Or similarly, Ramsey County's the 16th or the 62nd county, so the Ramsey County districts range from 621 to 625. So when we're happy to sort these, of course, however the committee members like, but usually we find it helps you see how your neighboring districts are done if they're grouped by county like this. We've got some total lines at the top, and the categories that Ms. Adrian's just mentioned go across the page here, and you can see how the funding varies both by the regional, the regions that we've set for you just to look at the top, and then by the individual district. So you can see the total on the very top line, and that very first column is the pupil count. We call it adjusted pupil units. You see for fiscal year 20, we expect there to be 957,936 pupils in our school system, funding pupils. And then each column thereafter on this printout is an amount per pupil. So the formula allowance, which Ms. Adrian's mentioned, is all the same. That's $6,312. And every district, regardless where they're located or what conditions they have, get that same $6,312. And then as you go across the columns there, you'll see the differing amounts to match that pie chart that we just showed you. And you can see the average at the top and the amount for yours. And those are intentional decisions the legislature's made about how that funding should be. Many of those are controversial and revisited each year. But you can see the variation among districts for each of those formulas. So that's how you read a printout. And we thought that might be helpful for you because you'll see a lot of these this session.
Thank you, Mr. Sharma. I think Representative Erdahl had a quick clarifying question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mrs. Strom. I count across the top, I guess, 15 different funds. You have the basic formula that they all get the same, and then 15 more, and then the total. The question is, how many funding formulas do we have, and are those 15 the answer to the question?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, those categories are the ones that the previous legislators have said are the right ones to be part of general education. Whether it's too many or too few, I think, depends on whether people feel they're adequately meeting each district's need. One alternative, certainly you could combine all of those amounts in one number. If you looked at the very upper right-hand number, you'd see each district, if you just gave that amount of money out on a per-pupil basis, would get $8,956. And you could look up and down the list and see if your district would be a winner or loser under that. And that, more than anything else, might drive whether one thought it was a good idea. But I think in all seriousness, each of these components, the legislature said, you know, that's something special that's particular to a district and something we should adjust for. And the two of them that have the biggest impact right in the middle of the page on a per-pupil basis, if you look at operating sparsity revenue, you can see the state average is only $29 per pupil there because it only applies to the very small districts in the state. But as you look up and down the list of those small districts, right on the first page, there are a couple of districts that get more than $1,000, one that gets more than $2,000 per pupil in operating sparsity revenue. And the districts would argue because they're geographically isolated, that's a good thing for the legislature to accommodate. The second biggest variable one is the compensatory revenue, and again, the very same thing there. The districts that have a large number of children who are eligible for free or reduced lunch have made the case to past legislatures that those variations are important, that if they have a higher concentration of funding, that the formula should recognize that. And then if you go to the third largest variation is in the referendum column, 5 from the end. That's the voter-approved amounts. You can see the state average there is $984, and as you look up and down the list, you can see some districts are more than double that amount, and others are just at the bare minimum that's the board-approved, $300 per pupil. So really, I don't mean to be glib about it, but they are categories that the legislature has looked at and says this is deserving of having a special funding formula for, or some, like the column called gifted and talented, that's the same $13 per pupil all the way up and down the list, but instead of adding that to the formula, those advocates for that program said that really should be a standalone component.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I think Representative Erdahl, I'm going to hold your follow-up question. I know Representative Grunhagen had a question. I already have you on the list. I know you have a little bit of your presentation left before we open it up to questions, so I'm going to let you continue. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. Adrians will finish up then, and then just for the committee's knowledge, we're happy to answer individual questions or sit down with groups of legislators, however folks would like to do it, to work more on each of these school funding issues.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members, and we'll quickly finish so we can get to questions. The only other thing we wanted to bring up, because you'll hear a lot about the special education cross-subsidy, and so this is, I'm not sure which page it is, but it's a chart that looks kind of like this, and so the title is the special ed cross-subsidy per ADM, and that's, ADM is the average daily membership. So it's another way of counting, doing a pupil count for the number of students who show up to class each day. And so this is from the November 2017 forecast estimates. So it will change as we get more updated forecast numbers. But we just wanted to point out where the trajectory of where it's come from since fiscal year 2003 up to fiscal year 2021. And so the solid line that's on the bottom, this is the line that's not adjusted for inflation. So at 2003, it was it was $453 per ADM. And then for fiscal year 2021, the projected amount is $958 per ADM. But if you adjust for inflation, there's still certainly a cross subsidy, but it doesn't look like it's quite as big. So it would have been $659 per ADM. Or I'm sorry, it's the opposite. It was higher back in fiscal year 2003. And then you'll see there was like a little bit of a dip for fiscal year 2010. We had a one-time infusion of federal funds at that point, but this is just to help give kind of a sense of how it's changed over the past couple of decades. And if you'll go to the next slide, I think this is the last one. This just looked interesting to us also to point out the special education cross subsidy per ADM by district type. And these numbers came from fiscal year 2016. And so you can see the statewide average is $832. But if you look at Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's $1,334 per ADM. So that's the highest. And then the other metro areas for like the inner ring suburbs, it's just over $1,000. For the outer ring, it's $895.
Sorry to interrupt, Ms. Adrians. I think people are confused because the PowerPoint's not on the right slide.
The point of this slide, though, is just that it tends to correlate to the student population count. So the higher the student population count, the higher the cross subsidy. It is a problem that's affecting districts across the state.
Looks like we're having a little bit of a technology issue.
Yeah, that's our last slide. So if there are any questions, Madam Chair, we're happy to answer.
First, I wanted to thank you. We gave you basically a monumental and impossible task to describe school funding in 30 minutes and give us a good overview, and you gave it your all, I know. And this document is going to actually be emailed to you electronically so that you have it, and then we'll also place it on the committee webpage so that we have it as well. And I know we are not a finance committee or a division, so I just wanted to give people kind of a general overview of where we're at and what funding stream schools have. And I know you probably have a ton of questions. If we're going to spend about 10 minutes going over whatever we can in committee, but feel free to contact Ms. Adrians or Mr. Strom, and they'd be more than happy to sit down with you. And on the list, I have Representative Rudolphers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, back to my question. I'm not disputing the merits of any of the funds. I'm just trying to get at, okay, how many different ways do we have to compute how schools should be funded? There are 15, but then you mentioned special ed. That's another one, or the 16. How many are there? Can you give us a number?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we can give you a number, and part of it would be what items in terms of adjustments you think would be reasonable to include on that. Ms. Adrians puts together a tracking sheet each year. And it's 5 pages of programs, but most of those are adjustments, because the way we keep track of education funding is we adjust for actual pupil counts after the year is over. So we'll have probably 2.5 pages of adjustments and 2+ pages of programs. So I would say line item appropriations, we probably have, what'd you guess, 110? Mm-hmm. Probably around 110 line item appropriations.
Representative Erdahl, follow up.
So, I mean, we have 110 different ways to compute how schools get money? Is that what you're saying to me?
And yes, Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, yes. And many of those are grant programs or small line items. For example, on Ms. Adrian's appropriation spreadsheet, the Community Service Fund includes things like early childhood family education aid and community education aid and school after-school enrichment aid and school-age child care aid. So each of those programs has an aid and levy component to it. So when you add those all up, we'll send to the to you and the committee a count without adjustments, but it's probably over 100, I would guess.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. I think what we're finding is I wanted people to realize how much policy affects funding, and I think we're definitely getting to that point. One more follow up, then I want to give other people a chance, Representative.
So, Mr. Strom, besides you, how many people in the state of Minnesota understand this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, I give legislators a lot of credit, and I think most legislators look through those spreadsheets and they say, these are the programs I like, and these are the ones that I think maybe next year we should do something about. So some of the formulas, there are a lot of pluses and minuses, but really it's not difficult math. It's mainly lots and lots of different programs. And the proliferation is often because somebody has a really good idea and says there should be money for this, even if it's a small amount of money. Or, for example, one topic that this committee will be talking about next week on the mental health issues. The approach the legislature took, they would have, I'm sure, preferred to have enough money to do comprehensive mental health money for every district, but instead there are several different grant programs that are used, and each may have a slightly separate focus.
Thank you, Mr. Strom, and I appreciate how politically correct you answered that question. You're very diplomatic, I should say. Representative Greenhagen, you had a question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple things. Number one, do we have any comparative data on what the five states around us, do they have, 100 different ways? Are they doing it in 50 ways? I think some comparative data would help lay people get a grasp of exactly the web we've weaved here. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenhagen, if we could sum the total number of programs for the five states around us, I think they would equal Minnesota's.
That's how complicated we've made it.
Well, I think most states have a higher basic grant. Most states have less individual program control, and for those that in many states the operating referendum is referred to as a mill election, and districts have much more flexibility on that, but also much more variation. For instance, in some states with great mineral wealth, the districts that have a millage there may have a significant advantage. So many of the school finance lawsuits, and this does not include our neighboring states, but many of the school finance lawsuits are directly around this issue of how much can a local do when another district may have very little tax base. But most states do not have anywhere near the complexity that we have in our school funding system.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. It's always a very delicate balance. Does anybody else have any questions?
Oh, I had a follow-up.
Oh, one quick follow-up, then I want to give other folks
okay.
a chance.
Where is the cost of the regional excellence centers? Is that the education excellence on this summary sheet here, or where does their cost come in?
Mr. Strom?
The regional centers.
Madam Chair and Representative Greenhagen, some of the detail that if you wanted to get into it shows up on the bigger tracking sheet.
Oh.
And that one shows up under the Minnesota Department of Education agency line item. And so the Regional Centers for Excellence, they are budgeted at $1 million per fiscal year.
Okay.
I think Representative Bierman had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chalmers, would you comment on how inflation is factored into these numbers, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, in Minnesota, the basic formula allowance is not linked to inflation, and nearly all of the other programs do not have an inflationary element in them. The two parts of the formula of any size that have, or three parts that have inflation, one of those is the special ed formula, which has a growth rate in it. It's complicated by a few factors, but essentially there's a 4.6% growth factor in the special education formula. So that's a big one and one of the few that's tied to inflation with a set number for inflation. But on the general ed side, the basic formula allowance is set for a two-year period by the legislature and remains flat for future years under the way it's been as long as I've been around. There, it has not been linked to either a percentage increase in statute or something like the CPI.
So just a follow-up, please. So it's as long as you've been around, but do we have any idea from any members how long these numbers have been static?
Representative Bierman, I think Mr. Strom probably has been around as long as almost every member here. So would you like to answer that?
Madam Chair, I've been with the legislature since 1984, and since that time, the basic formula allowance has never had an inflationary tie to it. But the legislature, each biennium, makes a decision about how big or small that should be. And one of the items that'll just be in your folders for you is the school finance guide. And there's a page in there that shows the percent increase that the legislature has approved each year for the basic formula allowance. And you can see how that varies over time. I don't remember the page number of that, but we'll tell you in a moment here on that. But as a mechanism, it hasn't been tied to the rate of inflation.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Any other question? Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strom, I don't want this question to seem prejudicial. It's only out of curiosity. I wonder if the average total per pupil costs in the charter districts is higher than the other public districts.
Madam Chair, Representative Sandel, that's a really good question. The charter schools in Minnesota are very bimodally split, and there's two reasons for that, one of which is charter schools often serve a specific level of grade. Some often serve only high school kids. Others serve only elementary kids. As I said at the beginning, our school funding system is based on our pupil counts, and they're weighted by grade level, with the secondary kids weighted 20% more. So many of the, if you do, and we're happy to send this committee a list of total spending by school district and charter school or total revenue either way, and you can see that the charter schools will predominate at both the top and the bottom of that list, in part because the all secondary schools are getting that 20% extra, the all elementary are only at one. And then the second thing in Minnesota, the charter schools tend to be very split. There tend to be a number that serve, that serve primarily low-income children. They may be 95% low-income, so that compensatory revenue is going to be quite large for them. And there are others that serve very few, well below the state average in students who qualify for free or reduced lunch. So out of the, I'll send a printout down because it's interesting, but out of the 165 charter schools, you'll see 20 at the top of the list and 20 at the bottom, and maybe even more at both ends. So very bimodally distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And not seeing any other questions, I think we'd like to once again thank you again, Mr. Strom, Ms. Adrians, for your quick overview. And like I said before, the documents will be emailed to you and then also on the committee website. And I think with that, we are going to have you clear the way for our little speed dating segments. And Mr. Benjamin is going to help facilitate this. And the first person, what I would ask of the stakeholders is kind of keep an eye on a list that was put out on the table. And if, as you see your name coming up, think about being on deck and being down there so we can quickly turn this around. I'm going to start out. First, we have the Minnesota Schools Counselors. Then we'll have AMSD, and then we'll have MSBA. I know, and there's three more that had asked to go up front because I know you also have a committee hearing going on in the Senate as well that you need to be at. So I'm going to have each group come up, give your organization's name, your title, and maybe any issue area you're going to be working with us on this year. So, Mr. Tilbury, would you like to go first?
Yes, I'd love to. thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tom Tilbury, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Counselors Association. And I am a former legislator, so this topic has been very riveting for me. And I know it very well when I think of the 100 different ways to fund schools. I remember that same conversation that we've had many years ago. And also, I've been a counselor at Roseville Area High School for the last 23 years. A lot of you I know, some of you I don't. However, I have spent a lot of time with the counseling aspect. About school counselors, often we're the first point of contact that a student has who is struggling or in any type of need in areas of academics, personal and social growth, mental health, and career choices. We also work in collaboration with other student support staff, school social workers, nurses, psychologists, and chemical dependence counselors. That's to ensure that all students have the support that they need and are able to reach their full potential. Research has shown dramatic benefits when students have access to adequate support staff, including decreased disciplinary and suspension rates, increased attendance and graduation rates, increased math and reading proficiency, and increased post-secondary enrollment and career readiness. And also, I'll add school safety. We play a critical role in solving our state's persistent achievement gap and also truly keeping schools safe. And I like to say that because relationships is really where it's at. You can have lots of metal detectors and things and protective devices, but what it really comes down to is the relationship that a student might have with a staff member. And it begins there, and everything else is just kind of gravy on top of that. The average school counselor, however, some of the difficulties that we have, the caseload in Minnesota is about 750 students, about three times higher than the levels recommended by the American Schools Counselors Association. We are grateful to Minnesota legislature and also to Governor Dayton for recognizing the serious problem back in 2016 when he invested $12 million in the Support Our Students grant program, which is one of those that are listed probably on that sheet that you saw earlier. This groundbreaking program allowed school districts to apply for matching funds for a six-year grant to hire student support staff, including but not limited to school counselors. The program was an overwhelming success. 77 new staff positions were hired across the state, 40 of which were licensed school counselors. The distribution of new positions was almost evenly split between districts in greater Minnesota and the metro area. Dozens of schools also applied and were not able to receive a grant due to limited funds. Also, depending on when that grant came out, it was in August of that year, and a lot of schools already had their budgets solved, and so a lot of schools weren't able to tap into those dollars. And I got two items, and then I'll move right along.
Thank you, Mr. Tiffer.
Unfortunately, we're still near the bottom of the state rankings. So students' access to school counselors in our state will be spending less than half of the national average on overall student support services. We do look forward to working with you. I know I've worked with a lot of you and appreciate it. And wish me luck as I go over to the Senate, and I can always say I've been house-trained.
As we do very much appreciate that, Ms. Tilbury. Thank you. Mr. Grinquist, and then on deck is MSBA and MREA.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Grinquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, or AMSD. AMSD represents 41 traditional school districts, 5 intermediate or cooperative districts, and 2 integration districts. Collectively, those districts enroll over one half of the state's public school students. And so this session, Madam Chair and members, we look forward to working with you to make sure that all of our students, regardless of race, regardless of economics, social economics background, zip code, you name it, all of our students need to have the opportunities they need to succeed. A couple of the policy issues, and I'll stick to policy, that we'll hope to work with you on. And as you know, many issues are both policy and funding. But we really want to look at increasing teachers of color and American Indian teachers. And there's a broad coalition. There's pretty extensive research that shows that this could really help reduce opportunity gaps and education gaps, achievement gaps. And so we look forward to working with you on that. And we would also ask you to be very mindful in terms of new mandates. In fact, we'd like to see some reduced if possible. One of the biggest things we hear from whether it's teachers or administrators is just the burdensome paperwork requirements that our schools are facing. And we think particularly in the area of special education, there's room to streamline and reduce paperwork without impacting services to students, because nobody wants to do that, but really just to make life a little bit more easy for our teachers and increase efficiencies. So I'll stop there because I know you have a very full slate, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Kroonkist, you get bonus points for going under 2 minutes. School Board, Minnesota School Board Association, with MREA on deck and that Education Evolving.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We represent every school district in the state of Minnesota, specifically all their elected school board members. I gave you two documents, and you'll find a colorful folder in there, one which talks about what we do as a service to our members. Many of the organizations you'll see here today work specifically on lobbying issues. MSBA has over 20 employees. A lot of our employees facilitate school districts with questions, election issues, going forward. And this is a very nice piece to look at to get the idea about who MSBA is. And next year, Madam Chair, we will be 100 years old, so we've been around for a little bit, too. On the other side of your folder, you will see a sheet like this. We tried to be a little bit creative. In the top side there is our policy points. The back side is our funding, so stay on the front of the page there. One of the things we want to speak about this year is school board vacancies. They're happening a lot. I heard of one even this morning where a school board member has been taken is slowly going to die from cancer. And normally he would leave the board and have that go forward and have the school board appoint an interim person. But the law changed last year, and it would require the school district to run a special election. Now, there are large costs associated, anywhere from $4,000 to $60,000 to run a standalone election for a school board member. We're asking to have that taken back. So if you're under or over 2 years of service, the school board can then appoint. The other thing we found when we really looked at this is some of those special elections, there was 1% of the population showing up. So we really don't think it's transparent to the voters or fair to the school district going on, and it's clear that it does run through board members' heads. Special education, Mr. Kuhnquist alluded to it. We would really like to see some progress be made going forward on this. We've worked on it through the summer, and we feel strongly that there are 10 pieces we can change that would not affect special education students, but would impact special education teachers by giving them less paperwork. And we hope not only could they spend more tasks or more time on tasks, but eventually that'll reach the special education students and having more time with kids instead of with paper. Teacher shortage, once again, Scott and I, got together and said that's really important. This is critical this year, folks. And we really need to see it happen. We're very supportive of teachers of color issue. And last but not least, you'll hear us talk about local control. We'd like to see the ability to renew a referendum. We'd like to reduce some mandates. And we need to provide some flexibility for local school boards going forward.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Now next is MREA and then Education Evolving and Education Minnesota after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Got a handout there in your folder if you want to take a pull that out. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of Minnesota Rural Education Association, in my eighth year after 36 years as teacher, principal, and superintendent in Greater Minnesota. MREA has on its board teachers, administrators, community members, and school board members, and we all take our role hats off and say, how can we do the best for students and greater education in Greater Minnesota? We also put our learners first to think about all of our collective future. So we take a longer view of some of these issues. How is that graduate going to actually function in society and move forward, and how does education get them ready? We serve 231 Greater Minnesota school districts and 30 cooperatives. Cooperatives are voluntary associations of districts that get together to do specialized work, and together they're educating 245,000 students. Mr. Kuhnquist is correct that over half the students educated are in the Twin Cities, but 245,000 is a significant number in Greater Minnesota. If you look over to the right, you see the policy issues that we're interested in. Career and college readiness is a big deal for our members. Our young people go to four-year colleges, two-year colleges, into apprenticeships, they go into certification programs. And so how do we provide a secondary education broad enough and yet rigorous enough for all these career paths and have student choice? Which gets us to the next bullet, the Minnesota Academic Standards. We think this policy committee, for the first time in 15 years, should have a conversation about what do standards mean at the secondary level. The last time the policy committee had it was in 2003. When the state walked away from the profiles of learning to take on the Minnesota Academic Standards, which basically have said if there's a standard and benchmark, every student all across the state has to learn that specific knowledge. We think we need to have a conversation about that. And unfortunately or fortunately, I raised that issue in the science agency process where they asked for comments on the science standards, and now many of you have gotten a letter from MINSTA, the Minnesota Science Teachers Association, saying I'm opposed to science standards. That's not the case. This is a larger conversation about the meaning of standards. It happens that the science is one of the first standards out the door. They're in process right now. It's a perfect time, as these standards are being reviewed and changed, to have this conversation at this level. You see the other things on this list. Finally, at the bottom is limited, focused,
demands. That gets to Mr. Kroonquist's issue about mandates. We know there's societal pressures to fix things, to do better, and we know you look at schools. We ask that when you do that, you're limited in number, you're focused on which students exactly you want to have this education, and they're implementable. Ask teachers and principals, how would this be implemented? That's what we ask of you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Nolan. And now Mr. Lars Esdahl, and then we have Education Minnesota on deck, then Minnesota Association of School Administrators.
Great. Greetings, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you all today. My name is Lars Esdahl. I'm the Executive Director of Education Evolving. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy organization. We work to advance student-centered learning for all students by supporting teachers that are designing and leading schools and by advocating for policy that's open to innovation. Our biggest priority in 2019 will be competency-based education legislation. Throughout 2017 and 2018, we spoke to over 50 educators, administrators, students, and organizational leaders about the policy barriers they face to doing student-centered learning models in their schools. A hallmark of many of their innovative models was reorienting their programs to focus on mastery of critical knowledge and skills that are aligned to state standards, rather than only passing time in seats and checking off courses. And we also heard from them, however, that it's important that statute explicitly authorize the sort of work they're doing and make it explicit that that schools can certify standards and award credits based on demonstration of mastery, regardless of time in classroom instruction. In addition to speaking to Minnesota stakeholders, we've also spoken with several national organizations that are leading this work in other states around the country, including KnowledgeWorks, INACOL, and Excel in Ed. We are currently waiting for draft legislation back from the revisor's office, and once we have it, we are eager to meet with and discuss with all of you the specifics of the legislation. Finally, in addition to competency-based education, we are also going to be working with PELSBY to advocate for standards of effective practice and unit and program approval that supports exposing new teachers to more student-centered practices in their teacher education programs. And along with many of the organizations here, we support the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers and the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition.
Thank you, Mr. Esdahl. Ms. Speck.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Denise Speck. I'm President of Education Minnesota, the union of more than 80,000 educators in Minnesota schools and on our campuses. 2019 will be a crucial year for education, and I hope that everyone can start their conversations from places of agreement. For example, there is now consensus that increasing our students' access to mental health care providers is vital to making our schools safer and increasing equity. While there are disagreements on the size of the problem and the investments necessary, we all accept the nexus exists. At Education Minnesota, we believe directly hiring more counselors, social workers, and other support staff is one solution. Expanding full-service community schools is another. On another subject, we all agree Minnesota has a shortage of qualified teachers, especially teachers of color. Our state must find ways to entice more people with deep content knowledge and training to make education their career. Just as importantly, we must keep the teachers already in our classrooms with better working conditions and enough pay to sustain their families. The issues around recruitment, retention, and licensure are braided together. Our union believes that the new law for licensing teachers needs adjustments, not a major overhaul. We are suggesting changes that will provide additional support to teachers who enter the classroom with fewer academic qualifications. And finally, we must do better for our state's education support professionals. Paras, custodians, hall monitors, secretaries hold our schools together, and the staffing crisis in these jobs is deeply felt. Living wages, affordable health care, professional development, and safe staffing levels are critical to recruiting ESPs and keeping them on the job. The need for new resources and policy changes is urgent. These are difficult conversations ahead, and for now, I hope we can agree on just one more thing. The problems are real, they're not going away, and the status quo is not acceptable for students, parents, or the more than 80,000 educators working today in our schools and on our campuses. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Specht. And next we have Ms. Valerie Doseland. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doseland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, or also known as MASA. Gary Amoroso, MASA's Executive Director, was not able to be here today, but he will be connecting with you in the coming weeks. MASA is an organization representing educational administrators throughout Minnesota. Our members include school superintendents, directors of special education, curriculum and technology leaders, and central office administrators. MASA believes that all learners deserve a world-class education, that public education is the cornerstone of our democracy, and that we must eliminate the disparities in opportunity, expectations, and resources that have resulted in undesired predictability in student outcomes. You will learn more details throughout the session about our priorities, but I wanted to highlight a few. MASA will be advocating for the proposal you heard from Education Evolving regarding moving from seat time to competency-based education. We ask that you refrain from enacting new laws that are unfunded or underfunded, and as you've heard, we'd like some repealed, too. And we will be coming and talking to you about special education mandates and regulations. And then also just want to be a resource to you. So if you have questions or would like to know, would like to reach out to any of our members, we are happy to help facilitate that. And we will be connecting with you in the next few weeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doseland. Now on the Minnesota State Academies.
Hello, everyone. My name is Terry Wilding. I'm superintendent of the Minnesota State Academies. And for most of you, you may not be aware that we are a state agency, but we're also a public school district, so we're very unique in that way. That also creates some challenges for us. I'd like to share some information with you about how unique we are. We serve kids from all over the state. We are not only focused in one region. We serve students from all corners of Minnesota. We serve deaf, blind, and deafblind students, and some students with additional disabilities as well. We also serve kids from 18 months old all the way up to age 21, following school law in regard to special education. We are 100% special education schools, so that makes us unique in many ways. And now for policy-related issues, we'd like to bring up some issues that have already been discussed, and we will discuss them again further. And I'm talking about the same thing, teacher shortages, funding for certain programs, support for curriculum. And we've also been trying to really be a resource for not only our students who come to our school, but for all deaf and blind and deafblind students in their own homeschool districts. So often that requires creativity in ways that we set up our program and that we set up policies. We need to be involved. We need your support in certain areas. Secondly, when you develop different programs and policies, please try to remember us, because often we're stuck between no financial position. We're often not qualified for some funding because we're not a regular school district. We're a state agency. And then in other ways, we don't qualify for other state funding because we're a school and not a state and a state agency. So we're looking for more opportunities. And when you develop new programs, please look at where we can fit into the system, because we don't have levy opportunities. We depend entirely on your support for any programs in our schools. And with that, I do want to extend an invitation to all of you to come visit our campuses if you're in our area. And I'd love to show you more about our programs. We serve the greatest need in Minnesota. We're a very low incidence school, so where disability needs, our deaf children and blind children are often misunderstood, and their needs are often misunderstood and underserved. So we're trying to improve that, and hopefully with your support, we can change that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilding. Now we have Minnesota Business Partnership, then On Deck at Allies, and then Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. And it's clear right now, members, that we probably will not get through this entire list, but what we'll do is we'll continue it on Wednesday, January 23rd, and I'll talk about that later. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. The partnership's members are the leaders of Minnesota's largest employers, employers like Cargill, Ecolab, the Mayo Clinic, and Hormel. And together they employ 400,000 Minnesotans and 2 million people worldwide. And while the business partnership isn't a traditional educational organization, we are deeply committed to the success of our students. For example, beyond philanthropic contributions and employee volunteers, our members have worked to provide opportunities for students and educators through PSEO, charter schools, and district self-governed schools. We've worked to pilot, evaluate, and expand the Parent Aware Rating System and early learning scholarships. And we recognize high-performing, highly diverse schools and share lessons learned. As our members work to improve student outcomes, we use four guiding principles. These principles are highlighted on the handout you've received, along with our recommendations. Given the time, I won't read the recommendations. Instead, we'd just like you to know that we share your sense of urgency in making sure that all students have a world-class education, and we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Croson.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joshua Croson, and I'm with Ed Allies, which is an education advocacy nonprofit that works on behalf of our most underserved students, namely our students of color, our indigenous students, and our students with disabilities. So Minnesota faces some of the worst academic shortfalls for communities of color and indigenous students in the country. Only one in three of our students of color and indigenous students are reading or doing math at grade level, which is actually lower than our low-income and homeless white student population. We also have some of the lowest high school graduation rates in the country for our students of color and indigenous students. In fact, we have more students who do not graduate high school on time every year than participate in the Twin Cities Marathon, and half are students of color. Race, like zip code, disability, and income, is too often a predictor for student success. These academic achievement outcomes are a direct result of what we as a state believe our students from underserved communities can achieve and the opportunities or lack thereof that we provide them. But we can solve this, and I'm looking to you, the legislature, to be that policy change maker for our students, especially our students of color, low-income learners, and students with disabilities. At Ed Allies, we believe we can solve this by ensuring our students have equitable access to resources, ensuring our students have teachers and school leaders who are highly effective and well-resourced, and ensuring our students have the ability to attend rigorous and engaging schools, both academically and culturally. And so to that end, I'll just highlight three policy priorities. First is making sure that our data is available, is collected, and is publicly accessible. Like Representative Herr mentioned yesterday, our data doesn't tell the full picture, the whole picture. We have to disaggregate that student data so we can understand some of the hidden disparities, namely in our Southeast Asian, African, and Latinx communities. We must also make the data accessible. And frankly, Madam Chair, our Minnesota Report Card is extremely confusing. I encourage all of you to play around on the Minnesota Report Card system for 5 minutes, and you'll likely agree that it feels impossible to navigate. We've heard concerns from parents that they simply can't figure out how their schools are doing. And so we request that the legislature help direct and resource the Department of Education to create a better school report card. Secondly, student dismissals. We have to keep students in school by using suspensions and expulsions as the last resort and not the first resort. At Ed Allies, we're a committed partner in the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. And just to kind of put this in perspective, we suspended and expel our Black and Native students at twice the rate of the average state in the country. About 15% of our students have disabilities, and 50% of our dismissals are populations of kids with disabilities. We dismissed last year 1,700 students for attendance-related issues. Our suspensions and expulsions are just don't make sense, and they're confusing. And lastly, I'll mention is licensure. We've made huge strides in our licensure progress to increase teacher diversity. We're a strong coalition partner to increase teacher diversity, and I would ask the legislature to help protect our Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers. And to create a Tier 2 to Tier 3 pathway that is just common sense and uses teacher expertise and experience. So thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go on to the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color. And then we have on deck Ignite After School, St. Paul Schools, and then Minnesota Independent School Forum.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kimberly Colbert, and I'm a high school English teacher serving as the co-chair of the Core Steering Committee for the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers. 3 years ago, the coalition was formed by 40 educators, higher ed professors, and community organizations around a common concern and commitment to collaborate and advocate for the increase of teachers of color and American Indian teachers. Today, we are more than 1,250 people from more than 60 towns throughout Minnesota who belong to more than 150 different schools, districts, institutions, or organizations. Our legislative agenda and the bill we have drafted are informed by feedback from hundreds of stakeholders, a true reflection of one Minnesota. Students of color make up 34% of Minnesota's total student population. Teachers of color and American Indian teachers, or as we say, TOKAIUT for short, make up only 4% of America's of Minnesota's teaching force. The extreme shortage of TOKAIUT lends significantly to other larger equity challenges in education and society. By filling this shortage with educators who look like me and other people of color, you are not only addressing this important equity issue, you are also addressing the overall teacher shortage in the state. Our bill focuses on important policy changes and significant strategic investments on three things. One, attract and prepare more candidates of color who are of color or American Indian through various programs for secondary students, non-licensed educators, and career changers. Two, increase teacher preparation program completion through scholarships and student teaching grants. And three, increase retention of teachers of color and American Indian teachers by supporting teacher mentoring, increasing teacher loan forgiveness, and making curriculum, learning, and work environments more inclusive and respectful of racial and ethnic groups. Thank you for your support so far, and we look forward to meeting you to discuss more of the details of our bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And then we have Ms. Dennison Kunin.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share Ignite After School's policy agenda with you today. My name is Carrie Dennison Kunin, and I'm the Executive Director of Ignite After School. We're Minnesota's statewide after-school network. Ignite After School's policy agenda supports a reinvestment in the after-school community learning program and will seek an investment of $12.1 million per year to support high-quality after-school summer programs that we estimate will engage an additional 12,100 low-income young people across the state. And because quality is key, we'd also like this grant program to include an investment in professional development and continuous improvement focused on after-school effective practices. By really investing in this program, we believe that we'll be investing in programs like what's happening in Long Prairie Great Eagle, where they've really designed this holistic after-school program that is engaging fifth and sixth graders in a STEM club where they're engaged in building circuit boards all the way up through high school, where they're working in work-based programs and young people can get certified nursing assistant training through a partnership with a local hospital. This program in Long Prairie Great Eagle and 13 others like it across the state were funded in 2017 by a $7 million per year federal program called 21st Century Community Learning Centers. But 55 programs applied for that money and only 14 were funded. That leaves a $12.1 million funding shortfall. And we recognize the power of after school to really help the state meet its education goals. And it's not a new idea for Minnesota to invest. But because there has not been an appropriation in the after-school community learning program since 2008, we'd like to see some policy changes and just some upgrades to the language of that bill. And we really think this matters because our recent RAND report shows that after-school programs provide cumulative opportunities to children over time, and yet higher-income families spend seven times more on enrichment opportunities than low-income families are able to. And the Department of Education, their evaluation of that 21st century program is really showing that when low-income youth, when free and reduced price lunch children and ELL children regularly participate compared to those with low attendance, they have huge impacts on their MCAs. So for free and reduced price lunch students, they're 10% more likely to be proficient in reading and 53% more likely to be proficient in math if they regularly participate in after school. So on behalf of over 50 organizations that are part of the Ignite After School Coalition, we believe it's time to really reinvest and make some updates to this grant program. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Coonan. And St. Paul Public Schools.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert Doherty, and I've had the pleasure of representing the St. Paul Public Schools since 1987. We have over 39,000 students, and we're probably the most diverse school district in the country, which has been a wonderful cultural experience for our city and our staff and our families. I'm going to just hit on a couple things that related to policy. I know that we're short of time. One would be that Scott didn't mention, and I think that's on our MSBA list as well, is to maximize the school trust fund land in a way that would provide more benefits to school, and we believe it can be done in a way that still protects water and the environment. That's under your jurisdiction of your committee. Another provision, as we look at extended time options, the department had a proposal a couple of years ago that didn't make it to the finish line that allowed districts to provide boost classes. So you could take a second scoop or a second hour of math or science or reading, whatever the student was struggling with, as part of the extended time revenue, and then an elective could be done at the end of the day, and that did not carry any cost. Like Scott, MSD, we do hope that you will resist the urge to pass any unfunded mandates. Another would be to, when you have more time, to kind of take a look at testing to make sure that the testing works better for schools and for teachers and helps inform instruction. Finally, to add CLEP exams for state reimbursement for low-income kids like we do AP and IB. We had a grant for our teen pregnancy program, and they earned quite a few CLEP credits during that program, and unfortunately, because of the cost of the test, it makes it unavailable to that, and that's an existing revenue source as well. Thank you. And finally, we have many, many terrific schools that are within 5 minutes of the Capitol, and I thank all of you who've taken some time to come and visit our schools, and I can't wait to show the rest of you. So I would love to invite you to come and any school of your choice, and I'll even pick you up and drive you there.
Thank you. And I think we're going to have time for two more, and then we're going to move folks to the Wednesday, January 23rd agenda. Don't worry, but we've been kind of keeping track of the handouts, so we'll keep your handouts and move that so you don't have to waste more paper. So we've got the Minnesota Independent School Forum.
Right, Madam Chair, Tim Benz couldn't be here today, so I'm pinch-hitting for him, but I'm happy to defer to my one of my other clients that is here today.
And that's Minnesota Association of Independent Schools.
No, actually, Marcus Pope with Youth Surprise. And then I can follow up after.
Sounds good. Mr. Pope?
Yes, members, representatives, my name is Marcus Pope, and I'm the Vice President of Youth Prize. Founded in 2010 by the McKnight Foundation, our focus is really on leveling the playing field so that all young people have opportunities to be successful and to contribute to our community. We're most known for our funding. Since our inception, we've granted out nearly $30 million to programs all across the state doing wonderful things, after-school programs, youth leadership initiatives. Another role we play is to really maximize the efficiency with government programs that seek to support young people. One such program is the Minnesota Education Tax Credit. It's a $250 million tax credit enacted in 1997. It is severely underutilized. Last year, I think about $12 million was utilized by low-income families. There's a number of barriers. One barrier that we're working on is the fact that low-income families don't have the ability to front the money, so we've instituted a loan program, no interest, no obligation to pay back loan program, where the tax credit is assigned to our lender that we're working with. So that's one barrier that we'll use our resources to eliminate. Another barrier that we're working on this session is the income guidelines. The income guidelines haven't changed since 1997. So currently the program isn't reaching the families that it originally intended to reach. And so that's one thing we want to do. We want to benchmark the guidelines to free and reduced lunch, which we think makes a lot of sense. The current guidelines don't factor in household size, so we'll do that as well. So we're looking for your support, and you'll be hearing more from us around this tax credit. Thank you much.
Thank you. And I think, well, Mr. Harris, do you want to just do Minnesota Association of Independent Schools, and we'll move Mr. Benz to the next week? What would you like to do?
We'll see if I can do 2 minutes and get it all done for you.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Shep Harris. I am a member of the government relations team at Frederickson and Byron, and we do work with Youth Prize as well. That you'll see here, we've got some other organizations that you'll be becoming more familiar with during the session that we do work with. For starters, I'm actually going to go in reverse order here. The Girl Scout River Valleys is an organization. You might have a handout there that you see that is asking for some financial partnership with the state. But in the event that the bill comes forward here to the policy committee as we discuss after-school programs, we want to just give you a heads up. We're working very closely with Representative Kunesh Podin on the bill, among others, and that specifically works with the highest risk group of young girls of color around our state. So we look forward to having a conversation with you about that. We do represent a couple of private school coalitions. One's more metro-based, and another one's more greater Minnesota-based. And when you think of certain issues about non-public schools, that's the way it's termed in the state law. We can say private schools, we can say independent schools, but we're going to be coming to talk to you about textbooks, specifically about making sure that teacher manuals are included in the textbook non-pupil aid. So you might be hearing about that here in this committee. We want to talk about mental health counseling. Right now in state law, it is only private schools can be reimbursed for grades 7 through 12, but not for kids K through 6. So we want to talk to you about that as well. There'll be some telecom aid that conversations, but also just as important, there's been a conversation about school safety, physical security. It's been this past year was all about public schools. We'd like to talk to you about the conversation about how that could possibly include private schools as well. So, Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for your time.
Wow, three organizations in 2 minutes. That's pretty good. Thank you, Mr. Harris. I apologize to anybody else in the audience that was here to testify in the list. We're going to move to Wednesday, January 23rd. We'll put you up at the top of the agenda this time. So that leads me to some of the announcements. Well, first of all, the reason why I'm having folks come up and talk to you, I know some of the members that have been on this committee for a while know all the players, but this is a way for new members and or new members to this committee to kind of see the folks that you'd like to work with. And now you have the opportunity. Use this as a nice reference guide. Bring it back to your office. So if you're thinking about a policy that you want to work on, these are the stakeholders that you can pull in to help you out. So we have next Tuesday, January 22nd, we are doing a joint hearing with the Education Finance Committee on mental health. And that will not be in this room. I repeat, it will not be here. We will be in Capitol Room 120, so the new House hearing room in the Capitol. We'll start at 2:30, and we have a great agenda laid out for you. And then on Wednesday, January 23rd, we're back here at 2:30, and we're going to be talking with the Search Institute, the Bar Institute, Bar Center. But before that, we'll have the remainder of our stakeholders come in and anybody else that still wants to sign up to speak. So go ahead and contact Adrian Benjamin to get on that list if you're not on the list already. And with that, members, we will adjourn.